Dear colleagues, I think we can start our beginner colloquium. Today, the speaker is Andrew Godwin from the Oxford University professor. He is a professor of materials chemistry. Some details about him. He was born in Australia. He studied at the universities of Sydney and Cambridge, obtaining PhDs in inorganic chemistry from the former mineral physics, from the latter. Following a research fellowship at Trinity College, Cambridge, he was appointed to the chemistry faculty at Oxford in 2009. Then he was promoted to full professor in 2014 and research professor in 2018. And he was recently, I think last year, elected a fellow of the Royal Society, the National Academy of the United Kingdom. And his core research interests are in the dual roles of flexibility and disorder in functional materials. And he's talk about diffuse scattering studies of unconventional magnets. Please.
I think it's on. Is that okay? Can you hear? Great. Well, thank you very much for that very kind introduction. Thank you to Lasso for the invitation to come along today. I have been to Budapest a handful of times, maybe five or six times before, but this is my first time here at the Institute, and it's a real pleasure and an honor to be able to give this lecture to you today. I'm under the impression that every day is as beautiful as this in early March. I'm sure that's exactly the case. So I'm going to speak today a little bit about diffuse scattering in some unusual magnets. I thought maybe just before getting into the science, I thought just give a little bit of feedback, a bit of background. I know that there's one or two students in the audience. So I'm a materials chemist. Please go easy on me. I'm based in the inorganic chemistry laboratory in Oxford. If you haven't been to the chemistry lab there yourself, it's actually quite a large faculty. We have about 80 or 90 professors spread across physical chemistry, theoretical, organic, and inorganic. So I'm based in the inorganic building, which is this one you see here, and my office and labs are just down on the bottom here. Oxford itself is about an hour west of London in a very beautiful bit of the country. It's an old university, and it, as a consequence, has lots of old buildings and lots of strange ways of life. So I thought I'd just give a couple of those just as introduction. These old buildings are nearly universally made from the local stone, which is this Cotswold stone. It's got a kind of honey color to it. So we've got some beautiful buildings, some odd ones you might have seen one or two in some movies. There's some odd things to do. It's in a floodplain, so there's lots of water, and you get around by pushing yourself around with a pole on little boats called punts. The students like the oddities as well. Whenever they go and do an exam, they have to get dressed up wearing bow ties and everything in order to do their exam. The examiners have to do the same thing as well. It's brilliant. So lots of strange bits of life, but it's a fantastic place to be doing science. So in my own research group, our focus is on disorder in materials. And we're most interested in cases where disorder is far from random, which is often the case in nature. So we use the term correlated disorder to make clear that we're thinking about cases where disorder is not random. And the real reason that we're interested in that as materials chemists is because lots of functional materials that end up in devices have structures that are disordered in exactly this way. And the way that we are brought up as structural chemists to think about the arrangement of atoms and solids is often from the perspective of something that's ordered and periodic and repeating. So trying to understand what sorts of disordered states are possible, how we control them as chemists, and the link to the functions, that's the kind of thing that we're interested in my own group. And so we actually are quite agnostic in terms of the kinds of materials that we explore. And I've just put a sort of fraction of different sorts of things up on the board here. Today, I'm going to speak mostly about some magnetic systems. And actually, I'll be doing this from a very fundamental magnetic structural perspective, but the sort of applications that these materials might find themselves in, and I'll touch on this at the end, is, for example, in solid state cooling, magnetocaloric cooling, and so on. But one of the reasons that we tend to explore this across lots of different areas is because, as you might imagine, geometry often plays a really central role in governing the kinds of correlated disorder that can be present. And as soon as something just depends on geometry, it often turns up in lots of different areas. And all we have to think about is the way that, for example, conventional crystallography that describes the symmetries of solids turns up in lots of different areas itself. So I know this is an audience with perhaps a variety of different sorts of backgrounds, and I certainly don't want to be patronizing. What I thought I would just start with is just some pictures of how we go about characterizing, getting across the experiments we use to characterize this kind of non-random disorder in different solids. And just as a recap, if I take something very ordered, like salt, and I fire a beam of radiation at a crystal of salt, I see an interference pattern that contains a regularly arranged set of spots, of Bragg reflections, of course. And we know from all of 20th century structural science how to interpret the arrangement of those spots and their intensities to say something about the size of the unit cell and the positions of the atoms within that unit cell. But if we go to something that's heavily disordered, like a liquid or a glass, the atoms don't know that they're sat in a disordered solid. They still interact with the radiation in the same way, but we end up with a diffraction pattern that now looks very different. And of course, we've lost all of our Bragg reflections because there is no construct such as a unit cell. The diffuse rings that we see still capture some information about local structure in liquids and glasses. And of course, there's an entire community and many experts in the audience in interpreting exactly those kinds of diffraction patterns. Now, the sorts of materials that we tend to focus on in our own group and many of the functional materials lie in between these two extremes, where you have a solid that is basically crystalline. Most of it is ordered and periodic, but there's some component of the structure that is disordered and disordered in some non-random way. And in those cases, you get a diffraction pattern such as you see in the middle. You have a set of Bragg reflections that, of course, tell us that most of the structure is periodic, and we can interpret those Bragg reflections using conventional crystallography. But superimposed on top of that is this smoothly varying continuous scattering called diffuse scattering, and that's a cousin of what you see on the right-hand side for liquids and glasses. If you see diffuse scattering, your system is disordered. And as a rule of thumb, the more beautiful the patterns in that diffuse scattering, the more correlated the disorder. Okay, as a rule of thumb. So, for example, I would look at this and say that looks really beautiful. And that tells me that there's probably an interesting problem there of disorder in exactly that system. Okay. Now, what I'm showing, these examples here are for non-magnetic materials, but there are lots of examples of magnetic systems where it's the magnetic component that's disordered. And it was those kinds of materials that I was going to spend a bit of time talking about today. And it turns up quite frequently in a particular aspect of magnetism known as frustrated magnetism. And again, I'm sure there are a number of experts in the audience, but just in case you haven't come across this, let me give a very simple introductory slide. So if I have a system of spins, and I imagine those, for whatever reason, the spins might be able to point up or down, we'd say that they have an Ising degree of freedom, here shown as white and black circles. If those spins are interacting to try and point in opposite directions to their neighbors, then the geometry of the system can prevent the material from satisfying those interactions in all cases. So, for example, in the triangle on the left, if I place one spin that's up and a neighboring spin that's down, I don't know what to do with the third site. Whether it's up or down, I will end up with one interaction that is frustrated, where the two spins are pointing in the same direction. That's the problem with a single triangle. If you propagate this into a lattice where you have lots of sites, then the best you can hope to do, and the ground state of this model, is to arrive at a situation where for each triangle, only one edge is frustrated, has two states of the same kind. And there's a famous result in statistical physics of Vanier's back in 1950 to show that this state, the solution to this, has a finite configurational entropy insofar as there's a whole family of these possible solutions. And he worked out the exact result of what that configurational entropy looked like at zero temperature in the absence of any other interactions to break the symmetry. Now, if you have a real material in which this occurs, the signature of it or a signature of that state is in these scattering patterns that I was showing you before. And here are four images. I don't know how well you can see them, but I've put a sort of white hexagon on top. What you should see is that there's diffuse scattering tracing the edges of that B1 zone between the Bragg reflections. Okay, and that diffuse scattering is characteristic of this so-called Ising triangular antiferromagnet, the name of this model. And the reason for putting four different cases up here, one of these is from a protein in which the protein can be in two orientations and it's frustrated. Another is from orbital occupations that are frustrated on the same lattice, another from magnetism, and another from charge distributions, just to show you that it almost doesn't depend on the underlying physical origin of what's driving this state. The state itself has a kind of characteristic pattern in the diffuse scattering. That model is called the Ising triangular antiferromagnet. And those three terms gives us the three ingredients you need in order to stabilize that state. So remember, Ising, of course, was the fact that we have an object that can be in one of two orientations or states. Triangular, the name of the lattice, and antiferromagnet, because neighbors are trying to point in opposite directions. And the point of this slide is just to illustrate that if you change any one of those ingredients, you go from having something that's disordered to something that has an ordered ground state. So for example, the trivial one is if I make all of my interactions ferromagnetic, neighboring sites trying to be in the same orientation, well, trivially, the system can order such that everything is in the same state. If I change the geometry of the lattice instead, such that it's based on squares rather than triangles, then I can now satisfy my rules and I end up at a unique ground state. And likewise, so it's a little more subtle, if I use a different degree of freedom, instead of a spin that can point up and down, say a spin that is free to rotate in a plane, an XY spin, then again, the system can find a unique ground state. In this case, it selects a so-called three sublattice model shown here by the three colors, red, green, and blue. So in this field, a lot depends on understanding what combinations of degrees of freedom, lattices, and interactions can give rise to different kinds of complexities in these solids. And this is a bit of a sort of overload slide, but just to show that there's lots of different examples that you can choose. And of course, in the statistical physics community, many of these models are well understood, often from the perspective of magnetic models. And as chemists, one of the reasons that I'm drawing little molecules and so on here, and I'll come back to this just at the end of the talk, is that often molecules or chemical components can have related degrees of freedom to the, say, the spin degrees of freedom of spin models, for example. So we can borrow a lot from that literature. So that's just a little bit of background to disordered magnets, the frustrated magnets in particular that I wanted to talk about today. The bulk of the sort of science content of my talk, I've split into three sections. I should apologize in advance. I just quickly translated this from Apple Keynote to PowerPoint just at the last minute. And it's possible, I'm slightly nervous, there's one or two slides that might not have made it across. So hopefully that's not the case. But anyway, we've got three bits to go through today. I'm going to spend a bit of time just talking, giving a bit more background on magnetic diffuse scattering in particular, the experiments we perform and how we interpret them, how we understand, use them to understand the arrangement of magnetic spins in disordered systems. I then thought I would share just two case studies from our work on different materials, manganese oxide and this material called GGG. And I would finish then just on some relatively recent work on using metal organic framework chemistry to make some new magnetic materials with unusual topologies. So the kind of classic example of magnetic diffuse scattering from a frustrated magnet really comes from the family of so-called spin ices. On the right-hand side, you see a magnetic diffuse scattering pattern, and I'll talk more about this in just a moment. But let me get across the idea of a magnetic spin ice first, in case you haven't come across it. So in water ice itself, the water molecules are arranged in terms of their positions, but not in terms of their orientations. And that presence of orientational degrees of freedom or configurational degeneracy was studied by Pauling in the 30s. And it arises from the fact that if your water molecules are arranged like this, I can change the orientation of one of these water molecules and sort of propagate that change throughout the lattice. So the basic rule is that for each water molecule, it's interacting with four neighboring water molecules such that it donates two hydrogen bonds in two directions and accepts two hydrogen bonds in two other directions. And Pauling showed that there's an infinite number of ways of satisfying that local rule on this lattice. Now, in the spin ice magnetic materials, chemically they're very different. An example here has the chemical formula homium titanate. And in that material, I'm not very good at this pointer, sorry. In that material, the homium ions are sat at the corners of what's called a pyrochlore lattice, these connected tetrahedra. The chemical environment of those ions is such that the homium magnetic moment can only point towards the center of one of those tetrahedra to which it's connected. So this one, for example, could only point here or point in the opposite direction. Neighboring magnetic ions interact with each other in a way that is trying to force them to point in the same direction. But of course, that's not possible on this lattice because this ion can only point along this axis, and this one can only point along that axis. So they're frustrated. The best the system can do is to have for each tetrahedron, two of the spins pointing in and two of the spins pointing out. And that gives a net moment in one direction. That's the kind of ferromagnetic component. But you'll notice that that rule of two spins pointing in and two spins pointing out is, of course, the same rule that exists in ice. And so the configurational degeneracy of water ice is one and the same as the configurational degeneracy of these spin ices. So just as the orientations of the water molecules in ice are not ordered, the spin arrangements are not ordered in these spin ices. And as a consequence, the diffraction pattern does not contain magnetic Bragg reflections, telling us we have no long-range magnetic order. Instead, we see structured magnetic diffuse scattering. So the presence of diffuse scattering telling us the system's disordered. The fact that it looks absolutely beautiful telling us there's probably something interesting going on with the disorder behind it. And the question, of course, is how one goes about interpreting these patterns and understanding what's going on in the system. I've just given the equation down the bottom for how neutrons see magnetic structure. I know this will be familiar to many. The key points to pull out from this is that going into the equations are correlations between the spin orientations shown here as vectors and positional information, the positions of the spins in space. So this function contains information both about the orientation of spins and where they are. If there were no correlations, this whole sum here reduces to one. And this structure factor would look just like a magnetic form factor. And I'll show you that in just a moment. You can measure these data experimentally. They're kind of a complicated experiment to do exactly what I'm showing here. This would come from a single crystal, probably in this case about a centimeter wide in each direction. So this is a chunky single crystal, at least for a chemist. And that single crystal would be placed in an instrument like this one, D7 at ILL, that uses neutron scattering and is built to be able to separate the scattering from magnetic component from the scattering from the atoms themselves. And that's what allows us to isolate the signature purely of the magnetic scattering. Sometimes you might not have a single crystal. Maybe in the lab you've made something that's more like a powder than a single crystal, or maybe it's too small. And in that case, you can't measure these sorts of data easily. Instead, what you see is an orientational average of this over all possible orientations. And then the data look really very information poor, such as you see on the left-hand side here. Just to interpret this one, the left-hand side of this pattern is the center of the one on the right-hand side. And the first broad peak you see at very low temperatures here corresponds to the position of this first main maximum. As you look further and further out, this next peak that you see, that would be the peak that's sat here, for example. So they're related to one another, but it looks as though you've degraded a lot of information in the process. What was I going to say? I was just going to say, yes, so if you see these sorts of things in a scattering pattern, it's a sign of magnetic diffuse scattering. And remember, it has the same origin as what you've seen on the right-hand side. So I was just going to show what in the field of neutron scattering is a really important landmark figure. This is a Nobel Prize figure. It literally did win the Nobel Prize for Clifford Short, because at the time, of course, the idea that you might have long-range order of magnetic moments in which they're not all pointing in the same direction, but they switch direction, was still controversial. Because if everything points in the same direction, obviously you've got a magnet, a bulk magnet, that can respond to a magnetic field. But if they're ordered and cancel each other out, you've lost the bulk magnetization, and not everyone believed this state could exist. So what Clifford Shull showed was that in this material, manganese oxide, which I'll talk more about in a moment, at low, as you cool the material down at a critical temperature, you start to see peaks associated with this alternating or antiferromagnetic order. And you can only see this using neutrons. You can't see this using X-rays, for example. And this is that magnetic structure. You have planes in which the moments point one way, then the next, and so on and so forth. But the keen-eyed amongst you will notice that even at room temperature, which is above the ordering transition temperature for this material, there's still a broad peak just under where the peak emerged here. And that's telling us that at room temperature, this system is showing magnetic diffuse scattering. In other words, the spins are still not randomly arranged. It's the kind of magnetic equivalent of a liquid phase, effectively. So I put this slide in just to check if you're awake, maybe. I don't know. I thought you might like an equation. I don't know. But anyway, the top equation is the one we've already met. This is the one for the scattering from a single crystal. And the bottom one, which looks a bit hideous, this is what happens if you have to average over all sorts of orientations. And really the reason for putting it in is just to show that even when you have that averaging over orientations, you still have information about the spin correlations. They go into these functions called A of R and B of R and the positions of atoms in space. So it still has that information buried within it. So what I wanted to show you is one of the techniques that we've been working on in the group to try and extract information from these experimental data so that we know what the spins are doing. And this is based very, very closely on the reverse Monte Carlo approach that Laszlo developed and his group have been developing over many years. Instead of the conventional reverse Monte Carlo approach, where one builds a model of the disordered material and moves atoms in order to match experimental data, what we do in this case is we build a model in the computer of our structure, we decorate all of our sites with individual magnetic spins, and we use those hideous equations on the last slide to calculate the magnetic diffuse scattering. And then we simply move our spins until we match the data. It's as simple as that. And we use the Monte Carlo acceptance criterion to decide whether or not we accept those different moves. And in this case, this had been done before for other magnetic sort of RMC codes. The only thing we really do differently is we don't worry about moving the atoms at all. We just move the magnetic moments. And there's some good reasons why that works and helps. So the bit of code that one of my students wrote is this thing called SpinVert, and it allows you to take magnetic diffuse scattering and build a model of where you think the magnetic moments are arranged. Let me just show you that with an example. And I just wanted to give a handful of different examples of disordered magnets as we go through. Oh, it's already started. This was one of the things that wasn't meant to ignore what's just happened on the right-hand side here. We'll get there. In this particular material, Heisenberg pyrochlor antiferromagnet, these kind of intimidating names. Heisenberg just means our spins can point in any direction. The pyrochlor lattice is the one we've already seen of connected tetrahedra. And the antiferromagnet is just saying neighboring spins are trying to point in opposite directions. So it has a very simple magnetic Hamiltonian that looks like this. Neighboring spins are trying to point in opposite directions. And the ground state is again known from theory. The ground state has this property that there's no long range order, but for any tetrahedron, the four spins, their vector sum vanishes to zero. And there's a very neat little geometric representation of that from these four spins to this little rhombus to show that gives 2 degrees of freedom, the sort of emergent degrees of freedom for each tetrahedron. Nevertheless, its ground state gives rise to magnetic diffuse scattering such as you see on the top. And all that these movies were meant to show were that if you take this SpinVert approach, this reverse Monte Carlo approach, and fit these magnetic orientations to the powder pattern, which looks like this black line, it should fit, hopefully. Oh yeah, that's about to start. So this is the reverse Monte Carlo. I don't have the little spins moving, but in your mind, you have to imagine all of the spins moving around in order to fit these data. And as it does that, because our computer model knows up from down and left from right, we can calculate the single crystal diffuse scattering. So in this case, we started with something that looks like it has very little information, and we recover the kind of patterns that are known from theory. We can also do the vector sum, and we can check that as this thing progresses, actually it satisfies this local sum rule that, the spins vanish to zero. So just by fitting to that, black line, we end up being able to work out what's going on in this particular system. And I think in the interest of time, I'll skip over that example. So I wanted to share with you just two different case studies where we're simply trying to understand what the arrangements of spins are in these slightly canonical systems. And the thing that is going on in the back of our mind all the way through this, the advantage of reverse Monte Carlo, or an advantage of reverse Monte Carlo, is that you don't have to assume anything about the answer. So there are lots of other ways of interpreting magnetic diffuse scattering data, but very often those ways start from some presumed model of what's happening in your material. So the two examples I wanted to give concern manganese oxide, which we've already met, and then another material called gadolinium gallium garnet, which I'll introduce to you as best as I can. So here was the plot that we saw before. This was Clifford Schulze's plot. Remember, the key bit here was the emergence of this peak at low temperatures. The temperature at which that ordering occurs, known as the nail temperature, is about 120 Kelvin. And normally, of course, the temperature scale associated with ordering of any kind is similar to the energy scale of the interactions that drive the ordering. But you can measure for manganese oxide the energy scale associated with neighboring spins interacting, and it's about 550 Kelvin. So in principle, just looking at the numbers, one should have to heat the system to over 500 degrees Kelvin in order to remove order. And at face value, this is, of course, why at room temperature, there's likely still to be some structure. Okay. So in the middle, what we have are some experimental measurements of the magnetic diffuse scattering. And these are taken from a single crystal. So we can resolve these in different directions. So we're measured on the SXD instrument at ISIS. And these large blobs that you see here, they correspond to the blobs that you see down the bottom here like this. So they're not magnetic Bragg peaks, but they're sitting in the position that the magnetic Bragg peaks will emerge from. On the right-hand side, what I'm showing is I'm trying to explain why this system might be frustrated, because the magnetic interactions between magnetic ions, the manganese ions that are shown here in red, sit on the face-centered cubic lattice. And that face-centered cubic lattice is made of lots of triangles. So neighboring ions that are trying to point in opposite directions are frustrated on these triangles for the reasons we've already seen. There's another important magnetic interaction that's one step along, the next nearest neighbor, and that links edges of the cube, and that's not frustrated, okay? So it's got these two sorts of interactions within the material. Okay, so now what we do is we just take our data set, our volume of data. We've got our reverse Monte Carlo approach. We build a model with lots of spins, and we fit the data as best as we can. And I can't quite remember the number of voxels of data here, but it's really quite a large data set that we do. And we fit that using a single model. So this is the kind of fit that we get. Some of you will have noticed these little patches over here, and that's because we've done something slightly naughty of just chopping out the nuclear Bragg reflections associated with this structure. But that's okay, because all of the diffuse scattering sits away from the nuclear Bragg reflections. And this function on the right is the difference between the two, and the fact that it's gray nearly everywhere is telling us that we're doing very well in fitting out data. So now that we've got this, we have a model of spins that we think will at least can account for the experimental data that we measure. This is at 160 Kelvin, which is where manganese oxide is in this intermediate regime. So we can start to ask questions of what the spins have done in order to give us that fit. So the simplest one to look at is this spin correlation function on the left. If I'm a spin, am I pointing in the same direction as my neighbor or not, for example? And that's what this function shows. These are increasing distances to the right. Nearest neighbors are pointing slightly in opposite directions, and so on and so forth. And all of this is relatively straightforward. The magnitudes of these correlations die off with distance, as people would expect. It has a characteristic length scale associated with it. But because we have a single crystal, we can also ask about correlations in different directions. And that's what this central slice is trying to show, a slice through a three-dimensional correlation function, where we can now ask how one manganese ion is correlated to other ones in different directions. So we're resolving information in a spatial way. You'll notice that these form shells around any given ion, in which you have antiferromagnetic interactions. In one set of neighbors, then you have ferromagnetic, then antiferromagnetic. That's this alternating red, then white, and so on as you go through these systems like this. And basically, it comes down to this rule in the bottom right-hand corner, that the correlations are ferromagnetic if the sum of the path distances is even, and antiferromagnetic if they're odd. And that basically just comes from the idea that if you're going antiferromagnetically, if you go once, you flip your spin. If you go twice, you come back to where you are, and so on and so forth. So on one level, all of this is straightforward. What we really want is some physical insight into the material. And I would say that this particular state is a good example of the kind of equivalent of a liquid for a magnetic system, because it's not long range ordered, but there are still strong interactions in the material. And an obvious question to ask is a magnetic liquid homogeneous? Is it the sense that the environment around every spin is roughly the same, in the same way that maybe the environment on the molecular scale in a liquid like water is roughly homogeneous? Or is it the case that one should think about these disordered states as involving domains of order embedded in something more disordered? And that's the kind of question that you can start to answer now by interrogating these structures. So the way we do that is we take our big reverse Monte Carlo boxes and we look for local order. The equation that we use to do that is just shown in the top here. And mathematically, this is just looking for order that's characterized by a particular periodicity k, and that decays over some characteristic length scale here given by the Greek letter xi. So there are, we can choose the different possible directions in which you could get long range order in this manganese oxide system. And at the end of the day, what happens is that we find that there are regions of strong local order of that kind, domains of that, living within this liquid-like state. So it's certainly not homogeneous. It's trying to crystallize magnetically in different ways, in different parts of the structure. And there's this kind of ether of poorly structured magnetic ions in between those domains of order. And you can see that by looking at the correlation functions here in blue, if you're sat within a domain that have some much longer length scale of decay, or in red, if you're sat in the matrix instead, and that's much, much less strongly ordered. So this is a kind of hidden domain structure that lives even in this manganese oxide. So I think with your permission, would it be all right if I took my jacket off? It's getting ever so slightly warm. Thank you. Oh, I said, you're probably all collectively worried about me expiring out the front or something like that. Thank you very much. It's great to be here in June. It wasn't like this in Oxford when I left. But... So I said that the thing to have in the back of the mind with these case studies is that RMC, reverse Monte Carlo, allows us to explore these structures without any a priori sort of prejudice as to what we're expecting to see. And I'd say that domain structure is one example of it. This other material that I wanted to talk to you about, called GGG, or gadolinium gallium garnet, is another example where the magnetic order that emerges was of a kind I think no one knew to expect. And we were only able to find it really by interrogating these reverse Monte Carlo configurations. Once you know to look for these things, it allows you then to go back to other calculations driven by actual energy terms, direct Monte Carlo and so on, and find exactly the same things occurring in those models. So I'll start this story just with a little bit of structure so that we know what's going on. This is a chemically reasonably complicated system, gadolinium gallium garnet. And what I'm showing here is the positions of the magnetic ions, the gadolinium ions. It's quite a large unit cell, but it has very high symmetry. And the symmetry is such that all of these spheres, which are different gadoliniums, they're all related to each other by symmetry. And that, of course, means that each individual one is in exactly the same environment as the others, up to some change of frame of reference, for example. So you could rotate or translate from each one of these to each other one. So there are these sort of, they call it a kind of hyperkagome network of connected triangles. And there are two of these structures that interpenetrate one the other. So it's kind of a complicated looking thing. But if you were a single gadolinium ion, remember they're all in the same environment, this is what your worldview looks like. You're a part of two triangles, like this, and you're sat in the middle of a ring formed by the other network. So every gadolinium, every sphere, is in the center of one big ring, and every ring has exactly one gadolinium in the center of it. So there are the same number of these spheres as there are 10-membered rings, such as you see here. Okay, it's a one-to-one correspondence between them. The crystal symmetry is such that you can define a local XYZ coordinate system for each of these ions as well. And these points will become important in a moment. It means when we look at spin correlations, we have a kind of local frame of reference that we can use to understand how spins are pointing in this material. Now, one of the things that had interested people in this particular material, GGG, is that when you cool it to very low temperatures, and here, well, it depends what your low, I was in the quantum optics lab this morning, where it was, what, 10 microkelvin was low temperature. So here we are at a 1,000 microkelvin, no, a million microkelvin. So it's really balmy, it's 1 Kelvin anyway. When you cool the system below 1 Kelvin, this is a specific heat, and it shows this very broad hump that people were worried about because it matches a hump in some of the magnetic susceptibility measurements of the material as well. It looks as though the material is undergoing some kind of ordering in this temperature range, but no experimental measurement of neutron scattering, for example, was able to show what this ordering would be. So in the field, they were using the term of hidden order. Some hidden order is emerging within the structure over this temperature range. And this taps into hidden order problems in other aspects of condensed matter physics, most noticeably, for example, some of the heavy Fermi superconductors. So we took some new neutron scattering measurements of this system as a function of temperature as we scan that hidden order transition. And then we used all of the approaches I've just shown you with magnetic reverse Monte Carlo to try and see if we could understand what the spins are doing as you cool it through that regime. So you've seen lots of these fits by now. So here are some powder data that we've fitted. On the left-hand side, we have some single crystal data measured experimentally and calculated from our model. Those of you who are neutron scatterers in the audience will know gadolinium is very tricky to use in neutron measurement. So we had to use isotopically enriched systems here. But once we do all of that, we end up with our models. And there's a few little bits and pieces we can take out of those models straight away. The first thing is the gadolinium ions, this is a projection of the orientation of the ions on their local axes. And those projections, can you see that you've got a sort of an equator of them? There are very few spins pointing along Z, they're nearly all in the XY plane. So locally, they're kind of confined to a local plane between the two triangles. The spin correlation functions that we've seen before, well, they just do the sorts of things that spin correlation functions do, positive and negative, and they decay with some distance. And the characteristic distance doesn't show any anomaly over that temperature range. So in terms of the ways that individual spins are interacting with each other, there's nothing obvious happening in this ordering process. And of course, this is what people already knew from the fact it was a hidden order transition. But given that you have a sort of local axis, you can interrogate the structure a little bit more deeply. And so one thing you can do is you can say, well, if I'm an ion, with my magnetic moment pointing in some direction, I can then look around the loop I'm sat in, for example, one of the loops I'm sat in, and see where are the other ions pointing. And what you notice at the very lowest temperatures, that if I choose one orientation for this, then actually all of the orientations around the loop are all fixed. They're all pointing, they kind of stagger up, down around the loop. And you can capture this kind of loop anti-ferromagnetic order using a sort of higher order tensor in the middle that looks a little bit like a pneumatic, that captures that collective anti-ferromagnetic order. The individual spin is still free to point in any direction. And if you take a different direction, you end up choosing, you know, a slightly different axis along which these have their anti-ferromagnetic order, but the anti-ferromagnetic order around the loop is constant. So what we were able to show was that when you go through this temperature range regime, what's happening is that this loop order is what's emerging. And it's not the interactions of two individual spins or neighboring spins, but rather the collective order of these spins within a loop. And we capture that sort of local spin or loop order in terms of this multipole And you can show that those multipoles are long range ordered in this particular model. That long range order develops over the temperature range, and that it gives rise to this hump in the specific heat. Okay, so this system's a weird one. It's kind of a loop multipole crystal that emerges within a fluctuating spin liquid. And it was the first of its kind, and there's now been a few others of these, of this kind of physics emerge. So hopefully the take home point is that it's a very bizarre looking magnetic structure, heavily disordered, lots of bizarre aspects to it that would have been very difficult to find using conventional approaches, but emerges from the sort of reverse Monte Carlo approach that LASSO developed. So in the last 5 or 10 minutes, let me just switch gears ever so slightly, and I'll introduce you to a bit of metal-organic framework chemistry. So I'm going back from the condensed matter physics world to the materials chemistry world. And I'm just going to talk about some magnetic metal-organic frameworks, just to show you the kind of control that we can have chemically over different architectures that may be of interest. So if you haven't come across a metal-organic framework before, let me just quickly explain what they are, what they look like. When we talk about frameworks, we mean a material whose structure can be thought of as nodes and linkers. The linkers link the nodes to form the framework. And the clue's kind of in the title. Usually it's the metal or inorganic component that forms the nodes. And then the organic bit is a linker that links that node to another one, for example. And there's lots of different choices of metals, and there's lots of different choices of organic bits. There's a few hundred thousand metal organic frameworks that are known. And one of the things that they often have is they have some porosity within them, like this yellow ball shows. That means that they interact with different gases. And the reason this chap is so excited about his metal organic framework is that his particular one was had a strong affinity for water. It's able to pull water out of seemingly dry air. And here he is, stood in the desert, I think it was Californian desert, can't remember which one, having got these bottles of water out of the air, powered actually by solar power in the background as well. So that's what he was happy about. So if you were a metal organic framework chemist, that's the kind of thing that you would do. But one of the ways that we approach the design of these materials is there's a strong sense that the structure of the framework is encoded in the geometry of the components. So I showed you one in which we had nodes. Each node was connected to six others to form a sort of cubic net. And that connectivity is kind of encoded in the fact that metal components want six neighbors in an octahedral environment, and the linkers link them in a linear way. If you use different chemistry that gives you a sort of tetrahedral building block, then you can design a material that has this sort of architecture instead. So in the field, we have very strong control over the kinds of architectures that you make. And from the perspective of the magnetism world, what this means is that we perhaps can make frameworks that might be interesting magnetically, but are difficult to find in conventional oxide materials, for example. And one example of that is this one on the right called the trillium net, where you have octahedra connected by a bent linker. And this gives you a chiral structure that is understood to be frustrated, but there are only model systems of exactly this material. So we've been exploring using MOFs as frustrated magnets a little bit. And you can do this in very simple ways. So you can take columnar ones and link them together on a triangular lattice to get the Ising triangular antiferromagnet, for example. And in this particular case, the terbium formate, we see that in this characteristic diffuse scattering pattern. We can do all of the analysis I've shown you before, recover the single crystal patterns, and show that in this case, you've got exactly that case of triangles with one edge doing something different to the other two. But one of the reasons that we're interested in looking at these is that we think these might be quite good materials for magnetocaloric cooling, solid state cooling. And I thought just before I show the last example to you, I'll just check in on what magnetocaloric effect means, what it means for cooling. So you know how a refrigerator, it'd be good to have a refrigerator right now, but refrigerator works. We take a gas, and as we compress the gas, we take it from gas to a liquid, and that liquid is more ordered than the gas, so it has lower entropy. We dump that entropy as heat that comes out the back of the fridge. And then what happens is internally, we cycle the system, we allow the gas to expand again, sorry, the liquid to expand into a gas. Its entropy increases and it has to take in heat in order to do that. So actually, these frustrated magnetic systems are really quite interesting in that same context, but from a magnetic perspective. So imagine I've got a system in which I have frustrated magnetism. So like I showed you on the previous slide, all these triangles, we know have one edge that's different to the other two, for example. And we know that system has a configurational entropy. Vanier told us that, but no net magnetization. There's as many upstates as downstates. But you can find ordered arrangements where again, you have one edge different to the other two, like these little hexagons here that are completely ordered, so no configurational entropy, but they have twice as many upstates as downstates, so a net magnetization. So if you think about it, I've drawn these sort of little schematic landscapes. You've got the disordered system that has, you know, a very flat landscape with lots of different configurations. And then if you could favor this state with two up, one down, then you would end up in an ordered state. You kind of pulled out one solution. So in these magnetocaloric cycles, what happens is you start with the disordered case. You apply a magnetic field, and that magnetic field pulls out, favors those solutions with more up than down. That's less disordered, so the system dumps entropy. What happens then is you then take off the magnetic field. It now becomes disordered again, and in that process, it cools the system. So it's basically a solid state way of cooling, useful, for example, in chips, or indeed you can apparently you can buy a wine cooler that is based on this exact problem. So let me just show you that we've managed to do this in one of these metal-organic frameworks. We don't need to worry too much about the chemistry. We're using manganese as our octahedral bits, and we're using something called formate as the little bent linkers to generate the first material that has this trillium structure. The trillium net is named after the trillium flower, which has this beautiful sort of threefold arrangement, and that sort of reflects the structure that you see here. So because we've been through lots of examples already, I'm not going to labor the point. Suffice to say that we've got magnetic diffuse scattering that we can fit and interpret. In this case, we can actually understand the underlying physics that's driving complexity in this particular material. We're able to pull out the energy scales of different sorts of interactions and understand what's going on. But finally, by applying a magnetic field, we're able to flip this into an ordered state that's so-called up, up, down, where we've got rid of the magnetic disorder. And that allows us to generate a magnetocaloric effect in this material. And that magnetocaloric effect can be measured indirectly using susceptibility measurements to pull out these entropy changes. And basically this brown region that you see here, these arrows that you see are what would correspond to the magnetocaloric cycle that I've shown you before. Okay, it's just at very low temperatures in this case, but we want to use those same ideas elsewhere. So that's all I really wanted to share with you today, just to give you a snapshot of some of the stuff in the group on magnetic disorder. And hopefully, back to the beginning, you'll remember that this is one aspect of the various different systems that we're interested in with disorder. And in fact, one of the things that we've been pursuing a lot over the more recent years is looking for mappings between magnetic states and structural states. And those sort of pseudo-spin systems obey the same kind of physics, the same kind of phase diagram, phase behavior, and so on, but are realized often have interactions that are on very different energy scales, for example. So you can do things like use spinning molecules, for example, that have angular momentum instead of spins, or you can use cyanide ions that can flip between two different orientations, and so on and so forth. So there's lots of chemical tricks you can use to access the same kind of phase behavior that we've seen with the magnet. So my take home is really that reverse Monte Carlo analysis has been absolutely crucial for this aspect of our work. It provides a really robust way of interpreting magnetic diffuse scattering of the disordered magnets. It's relevant to lots of different sorts of systems. I've shown you metal organic frameworks. I've shown you manganese oxide and gallium garnet and so on. And this key bit is it's kind of model independent insight into what's going on in different systems. And I see that as its key strength. So let me just finish by thanking the people who've been involved. This work is highly collaborative, in particular with central facilities. The person that I really need to single out is Joe Patterson, who's up here. And he's my former student who is now at Oak Ridge. He's doing fantastic work there. And he's the person that wrote that code that has been instrumental for what we've been able to do on frustrated magnetism. And of course, I'm very grateful to the European Research Council for funding our research. So that's our group at Oxford. They're all looking pretty happy. I've been delighted to be able to share some of that work with you today. And I'm sure there's time for questions if there are any. So thank you very much.
Thanks so much for this excellent talk. We have time for questions.
Thank you for the talk. So the reverse Monte Carlo method allows you to set up a model, numerical model for this frustrated magnetic state. And how does this solution refer to solutions that you get from some Heisenberg type of models that you apply for the given composition of the material?
Yeah, so that's an excellent question. And usually, though I didn't talk about it, after we've done a reverse Monte Carlo fit, we will try and understand what's the actual Hamiltonian that's responsible for what's happening. And then we can use conventional Monte Carlo, for example, to simulate what we'd expect, for example, for a Heisenberg model. And we can compare then whether or not what aspects of the structure we're missing or not getting. And depending on the physics of the individual system, we might find that we've captured everything or that we haven't captured what we needed to. So a good example is the gadolinium system that I showed you. And ordinarily, you'll know that gadolinium is usually magnetically isotropic. It's unusual. I told you that it has this spins are all lying within the plane. And that's unusual for gadolinium by virtue of its electronic structure. But it turns out to happen in that material because of dipolar interactions from one ion to another. Now, when people had modeled this using the Heisenberg Hamiltonian, that Hamiltonian does not have that local anisotropy in it. So when you use the Heisenberg Hamiltonian by itself, you don't recover what's going on. But knowing what you know from the reverse Monte Carlo simulation, then you can carry out an XY simulation instead, local XY Heisenberg exchange, and then you recover what's going on. So it's an interesting, I find kind of an interesting interplay between experimental refinement of the correlations and then attempts to interpret that in terms of the fundamental physics, the interactions that are driving that. Does that answer your point?
Questions? Just personal questions. What is the added value of being a chemist? Because my impression was that you could easily go to any physics department.
So from our perspective as chemists, you mean personally for myself or in general? So I would say more generally in chemistry, I think that there are a lot of systems like the metal organic frameworks at the end that historically haven't been explored in that context. And so the advantage perhaps from the chemistry perspective is that there might be systems that wouldn't otherwise have been obvious to explore that might now be being explored. And I think that's happening more generally. Personally for me, the process of learning about frustrated magnetism exposed me to a lot of theoretical models that I wasn't exposed to in my chemistry undergraduate, for example, but are thoroughly relevant to lots of systems. And I was hinting at that at the end with the pseudo spin systems. So I have learned a lot through the process. I've still got a lot to learn, but I really see the value of that in understanding the phase behavior of lots of different, and this is well known in the literature, obviously, you know, liquid crystal phases, pneumatics, and so this has long been there, but goes in and out of favor of undergraduate curricula, for example. So I think these models are extremely important to us as chemists, and we've got a lot to learn from. As I did first.
So it's about the GGG system again. You showed us this strange anti-ferromagnetic behavior, but how did you notice it? I mean, especially if these spins look into different directions and the only rule is that they have to be up and down, up and down. I mean, did you have a look at the configuration or did you have some... I mean, if you look at, for instance, an individual ring that you showed, do you see it? Or you have to collect a lot of...
Statistics. Yeah. So there were two steps to this. One was that... So the first one will sound very sort of hand-wavy, but when you look at the configuration, to the eye, it looks more ordered than anything you calculate. So when you calculate the spin correlation functions and they die off really quickly, you'll know yourself from looking at structural models, your eye is actually very attuned to saying, hang on, there's something going on here. So it took us a long time to find it. The big advantage of GGG is... that the symmetry at the gadolinium site is 222. And that allows you to identify uniquely an x, a y, and a z axis, I was saying. So unlike many other systems, what you can do is you can say, I'm just going to look at the correlations for, say my thing is, my spin is close to the x axis. I then look at all of the spins in all of the configurations I've done that are close to the x axis. And now I can plot these vector correlation functions with the other spins to see if I'm pointing at x, how correlated or not is it with its neighbors? And based on the spin correlation function that dies off after the first nearest neighbor or something like that, you're expecting it to vanish. But instead, no, you've got this alternating order. And so then we said, well, is it special to that angle or another one and so on? And everyone you look at it, it has this loop order. So once you have that, you can then say, well, okay, well, what's the meaning of that order and how do I capture that mathematically? And then now I can calculate actually an order parameter associated with that for these different configurations. So I don't think we would have been motivated to look for it were it not for the fact, as bizarre as it sounds, that the human eye is quite attuned to higher order correlations in systems. And when we look at things, we can distinguish them in a way that when you're looking at pair correlations, it doesn't necessarily happen. It may not be the definitive way of thinking about it. It's a way that we found to think about it, and it emerges over that length, over that temperature scale. And it could be there are lots of other systems that have equally bizarre kinds of order. So again, I don't know if that answers your question. Sure.
This is related to our current state around here in Hungary. I mean, if somebody would ask you about the innovative value of your research,
zero.
So how would you sort of turn all these nice papers and this nice work into something that our agency might be able to accept as a reason of research?
Well, I don't know if I have the answer to that. That's
of course.
But,
what do you think?
But very often, obviously, when it comes to writing a grant on these, it's hard for us to say. It's always hard to get a fundamental science grant, right? Because, you know, you can say it's sort of a fundamental interest. And, you know, particularly in materials chemistry, people want things to do things. So obviously, when we write the grants, we try and package up some of the obviously sort of applied materials. In the UK at the moment, they love a battery. You know, if I could have made a frustrated magnet battery, that would have gone, you know, absolutely, exactly. Just put battery at the end of it, you know, and so on. That would be fine. So it's a matter of mixing these things up. But actually, one of the things that I have a strong preference for the fundamental side of things, as you probably know. But here I am joking about batteries. And actually, we've got a project at the moment with the battery team where a lot of the work we've been doing on vacancy distributions and correlations in vacancies are entirely relevant to how these batteries charge, discharge, their reproducibility, the cycling, and so on. So actually, I don't think it's a hard argument. But it can be a hard argument to make, but it's not an invalid argument to say that the fundamental stuff really is going to be important for us understanding these applied phases, because geometry plays such an important role. You know, I think it's the geometry that links it. So why not look at simple model systems, or where it's not obviously useful, but the rules you learn from that are going to be crucial to understanding the more functional materials, I would say. Well, you probably don't believe me even now. It's just...
I would like to raise exactly the same question, but from a physicist point of view. So what is the macroscopic manifestation of these disordered magnets? So how this microscopic property that you find ordering disorder, how does this translate to some macroscopic? You mentioned as an
just
example
the
magnetocaloric
that's right. So that's probably...
Are there any other examples?
For frustrated magnets, well, you end up with susceptibility anomalies, but I'm not sure what you're going to do with that other than something, you know, whenever you've got entropy, then you can dump it in some sort of cooling, for example. So I think in that field, it is difficult to know, well, what's the sort of, you know, what's the sort of property that I'm going to associate with those systems? You'll know, though, that a lot of those ideas of geometric frustration and many of the models that are developed for that play a role in high-temperature superconductors. That's not my area, but that theory has overlapped. And what we're using from the magnetochlorics, for example, I didn't talk about it today, but you can apply those same ideas in barochlorics that operate at completely different temperatures now with pressure rather than, or piezoelectrics rather than using. So in frustrated magnetism, I think it's a slightly tricky argument, perhaps, but there would be others that would be a better place to make that argument than that.
Just a more theoretical question. In the theoretical point of view, there is this order through disorder phenomenon.
Yes.
And this means that usually a functional disorder makes select one ground state.
Yeah.
And in experiments, can you see something which is relevant in this?
Yes, I don't think any of the examples I gave today have an order by disorder transition, but it is quite common in this field, of course, that the, particularly at low temperatures, a particular state is selected for exactly those reasons. I'm trying to think of an example off the top of my head. I probably need longer than I'm... I was at a talk last week where they were looking at, I showed you this spin ice picture where you have spins two in, two out, and you can make a variant of that in which two of the magnetic ions are different to the other two. So they have a different coupling. And that produces this interesting case where you have chains. If you follow it through, you have a chemical chain of one type, loops of one chemical type, embedded in loops of the others and so on and so forth. And this system shows the ice-like disorder at one temperature regime, and then at a lower temperature regime, it undergoes an order by disorder transition in which you have antiferromagnetic order along the loop, and it fluctuates. And what drives it is that you can increase the entropy of that particular loop system at that temperature by having it ordered. I've not given a very good explanation of that. I only heard the talk last week, but I was trying to listen. But yeah, it turns up in lots of the systems. Yeah. Thank you.
I would have a methodological question. You have the configuration space, and then you have the data in Q space, which you would like to describe. And you have the technology of reverse Monte Carlo in between. Nowadays, artificial learning, deep learning is not only a hype, but also a technology. Did you consider using it?
That's a great question. I think there are probably two possible ways, but maybe you've thought of others in which one could use it. So the first answer is no, we're not using it at the moment. But you could imagine, I know that there are sort of two kinds of discussions or flavors of discussions going on. So one is, and I'll say this in the broader context of disordered materials. So one is, I showed you that picture where you have diffuse scattering that looks similar for very different physical materials, but they all, that diffuse scattering all arises from the same Eisen triangular antiferromagnet structure. So on one level, you can use, in principle, machine learning to take lots of different diffuse scattering patterns and try and work out which ones are similar to others, such that when you measure a new pattern, you're using basically just standard ML approaches to say this is probably an Ising triangular antiferromagnet or something like that. That's probably pretty straightforward to do. The other approach is less in the magnetic systems and more in structural disorder, where it turns out the reverse Monte Carlo can be a bit trickier. So what we're tending to do is to couple the reverse Monte Carlo refinements, where you move atoms and fit your data, with some knowledge of the interaction between the atoms. And the way that we're approaching that knowledge of the interaction is to use machine learned potentials. And so there we are using AI ML approaches to generate the potentials. The difficulties we're talking about at lunch today is that at the moment, in order to get a good potential for one particular chemical system, it takes a lot to train that, and it's trained for that specific system. So a big challenge in the field is how to do this in a more general sense. The ultimate goal would be for any material, disordered or not, I make some measurement of its scattering pattern, and I use a combination of ML and smart methodologies for fitting data to learn what's driving the complexity and how to understand the complexity. And I think we're probably quite some way from there, but whether ML can play a role, I think will be an interesting. So I don't know if that answers your question.
After this interesting scientific question, may I have an educational one? I am sure that you are very proud on your group on your last slide. And if I look them, I think half of them looks master student and half of them doctor students.
Yeah.
So in this field, what you presented in your talk, which looks very complicated, in some sense, state of the art, thinking and methodically solvable field. So which type of topics can you give to such a young people? So what they are doing in your group and how can you attract their interest to work with you?
That's a great question. So they'll be delighted to know. Well, I don't know. When you're young, you don't want to be called young, do you? You want to be called old. But I don't know if they'll be delighted. I'll tell them. But so in chemistry at Oxford, we have as part of the master's course, the fourth year of the undergraduate is entirely research and it's compulsory. So every student that learns chemistry in Oxford has to do an entire year of nothing but research embedded in the research group. And they have no choice, have to do it. So the reason you see quite a few of these is because these are master students. The ones, some of these ones up the front here were master students, I think here were master students at the time. And of course, it's great fun because they get thrown into research. They take your word. So if I say to them, frustrated magnets are interesting, then they just believe me. It's great. They're not like a funding agent or anything like that. They're yet to get skeptical about it. So it's from a supervisory perspective, it's actually a great way to test little projects. You know that you can't ruin their career. It's not like a graduate student, you give them something and it fails and it doesn't, and that's the end of their career. So that's a nice aspect that I think answers at once why some of them look quite young and also how you can get them to do stuff that you might not otherwise commit. I would say as a group as a whole, I don't know if this plays into the young group, but actually we draw students that come from both chemistry and physics backgrounds, also materials. We've had some mathematicians in the group as well. And of course, you know, I would always say the atoms don't know, you know, they don't know what you're meant to be. So that's always been really valuable whenever we've had that. And most of the group do not work on frustrated magnetism. I'm not sure we have anyone working on frustrated magnetism at the moment. And if you were being a Johnny in the top left-hand corner, there is. And because it has to be of interest to a particular person like that. But I think that sort of culture of having lots of different backgrounds scientifically has been really, really helpful for our end group in particular. Yeah. So I don't know if you have a similar system. We call it the part two system for undergraduates in the UK, but it's a bit unique. It's very similar. Yeah.
I think we had a good discussion and a lot of questions. So thanks again for coming. Thank you.